This conference will now be recorded.
Today, you know, they look at every problem and they think that it's a problem that can be solved by the application of technology, delving into the data, creating an algorithm or doing something like that. And, you know, occasionally it is the right answer, but I think we can all kind of agree that a bowl of cereal is not a balanced diet, and the technology and the application of artificial intelligence or an algorithm or something like that is not always the answer. And I think the point I'm trying to make here is that the first thing we should always be considering is, actually, is technology or is the solution we're proposing the best solution? And, you know, the best solution doesn't always have to be the fanciest. Sometimes simple is better. So kind of leads me on to the thought around, a question I hear a lot of people ask as in forums, especially, is, are we actually just getting the AI that we deserve? And I think that this is a really interesting side of the debate. Trying to move through this really quickly and sum up what the ideas here are generally, but you know, we have the opportunity right now in everything that we build to make choices, and every stage of creating an artificial intelligence solution, a machine learning driven solution, an algorithm, whatever you want to call it, every time we make it, we try to solve a problem using these technologies, we're making choices and we're making decisions. And as we'll look at in more detail just now, actually, it's the decisions right at the start, at the outset, where we try to define the problem and where we try to define routes to solve that problem, that we actually are defining the outcome. And there is quite often a big disconnect between what we say we want and what we actually get. The disconnect tends to be those decisions early on in the process. So I want to kind of explore what sort of mindsets might generate better results versus mindsets that may not. I'm going to, just checking on time here, 12:46, I'm going to whiz through the next few slides, and I expect that you're going to have a lot of questions, because actually I'd like to get to the end of this and have as many questions as possible from you guys. So I'd rather spend some time, more time answering everyone's questions than going through my slides. I think that'll be more fun. And I think also that this topic is thought-provoking and question-provoking enough that we'll have enough interesting questions to discuss at the end. So I'm not going to get too deep into this, but I just wanted to quickly touch on, before we get right down into the weeds of some of the issues, on a bit of an update on where things are since we last spoke. When I last made this presentation, I think in actually the first year of this presentation, this is I think the third time I've spoken, Dan. The first time I made this presentation, we were talking about what's kind of hot in AI, and where the big advances are being made. And I mentioned a couple of areas in terms of natural language processing, natural language understanding, machine learning, and particularly deep learning. And reinforcement learning is an aspect of machine learning which is starting to show some of the greatest potential and greatest rewards. And this is just a very simplified diagram to kind of explain the concept behind reinforcement learning, because I think it's something that's worth understanding. And you know, the basic premise of it is that you set an agent in this example, by the way, and in most of these things, is what you call your algorithm, your AI. So the agent is given a state that it's that it needs to achieve, and it gets a reward if it can achieve that state, and it puts an action into an environment, an operating environment, to try and obtain its reward. So basically, it's a simple incentive loop in a lot of ways, and a number of times that this loop can run can very significantly impact the ability of a simple machine algorithm to infer quite complex outcomes and quite complex results. So it's similar to the principle of when you see large flocks of birds kind of flying around in the sky in these amazing patterns. You know, how do they do that without crashing into each other? And actually, when you get break down the rules of that sort of behavior, it's just the bird that is following the bird in front of it. And as long as it follows the bird in front of it and pays attention to the bird either side of it, so as not to crash, you can have one bird leading and creating these really complex organic shapes. And the same sort of thing happens with reinforcement learning. And the reason it's so interesting and exciting is because it allows us to allow machines to effectively train or teach themselves. And that's because we set up an environment and we set up a set of desired outcomes and rewards to incentivize the machine to move towards those outcomes and then let it run. So I think with this sort of stuff in mind, I wanted to get stuck into talking about the A-level results in particular. And the A-level results in particular are quite interesting because actually they are a failure of choice really around which approach to take when handling various data sets to then apply those data sets to a model. Your model is your algorithm, the bit that does the processing. So at the outset, the department at Ofqual had a set of data, right? They knew how students had performed at various schools in the previous years, and they knew what teachers predicted students would perform in this year at various schools in various subjects. And the idea was to use those two pieces of information to predict how likely it was that a school would achieve a given set of results, and to also predict based on the teacher's predictions versus actual results, and here's one of the first problems, where a range of pupils' predictions might actually end up at the end of the year. So the first problem there is in comparing, right? They compared actual results from 2019 with predicted results from 2020. And one of the other things they did was they asked that in every class or every subject in every class, that the teachers ranked absolutely the students' position in that class, so their likelihood of where they would come. But in a small class with in a small school, it's very simple to rank three students in three places, but there's not an infinite number of places in the ranking system in terms of A-level total results that you could give. So even though you had to give each student a place, you also had to give each student a unique place in that. And so instead of being able to rank students something like this, where you might say that Amy and Stuart are equally likely to achieve this same result, and then Joe would come in second and Phoebe third, what actually happened was that they had to rank the students out, which meant that instead of Laurent scoring a six and Jennifer scoring a six, they ended up being shunted down a grade into seven and eight, and the same for most of the other results. And this this desire to stick too tightly to ranking and to give that the ranked results prominence in the data is the source of the bias in this whole A-level fiasco. So without getting too far into the weeds, because I think that's probably deep enough for most people, basically, really at the very outset, when they had the data and they were looking at what they wanted to achieve, they made some very poor decisions around how to handle the data in order to achieve the outcome they were looking for. The outcome itself was admirable and worthwhile. In fact, using an algorithm to predict where the students' results would end up is a fairly reasonable use of this sort of technology. And the inputs that they had were quite were relatively good quality. You know, we know the trend across schools. There would have been ways of compensating for the school size, which is one of the other problems that was introduced into the data set, comparing schools with very large pupil groups and very large classrooms to schools with very small classrooms. That's sort of the difference between private schools and state schools. And the smaller classrooms then tended to see sort of a 4%+ increase in their total results, whilst larger classrooms had their results downgraded as a result of this ranking that you see here. So there were some fairly predictable outcomes if the time had been given to do a little bit more of the work around the data science. And so this, I guess the big point here, this is not a problem with the AI or with the algorithm. This is a problem with the choices made around handling the data and the availability of data. So I think the obvious question, the obstacle or sort of ethical consideration here is, well, is it right to use an algorithm to make a decision about someone? And I will put myself out on a limb here and say, in a lot of cases, actually, yes, we already do it. We do it quite well. And you know, and for in a lot of ways, and in a lot of it, spheres of our lives, the algorithms that are making decisions for and about us are doing quite a good job, and we're quite happy with it. But when the what's at stake is greater. So for example, with the A-level results, one of the reasons it causes such a stink is because we're talking about the future of a young person's entire academic career in a lot of cases. You know, it could affect their placement at university and their career opportunities and a whole host of other things, not to mention their feelings of self-worth, their psychology, their self-confidence, and so many things tied up in those results. And I think that when the stakes get that high, this is where the time to take time and to over to look for a simple result rather than a technology-based result can actually pay dividends. And I think the simplest error that that happened with the A-level results is simply that the regulatory bodies and the government sought to use technology to solve a problem that they should have done in a much more analog way. And they ended up doing that. They ended up taking the predicted results that the teachers had for their groups and using those to score students. So how could this have been avoided? And what sort of mindset might we have taken to get around this? Well, I think the first thing you want to look at is what does an automation first mindset involve? So number one, you need to have clear goals and you need to be able to report on progress. Number two, you've got to be able to find really high level sponsors that understand what decisions are being made. You need to have a robotic operations center. That's, you know, a team, a group of people who actually understand the problems and who are understanding how to operationalize the outputs. You've got to build an experience that actually improves on the status quo. And you need to really be careful of people's psychology, of the impacts of any decisions you make, especially, you know, as we discussed, as you go higher up the value chain. This is based from an employee perspective, but you know, from the perspective of an A-level student or the end user, you know, how happy are they to have a decision, that particular decision made by a robot or an algorithm? And you know, how comfortable are the people who would have previously made that decision with handing over part of that decision making to an algorithm? And I think, you know, we saw early on in this that teachers were not very happy with handing over that decision making process, as and neither were exam boards, And I think that, you know, those are some really big red flags that can help to avoid these sorts of problems. So just time check here, Dan, how am I doing on time to run?
Yeah, you're fine. I'll, you know, if you want to talk for maybe another 10 minutes.
Okay, I think we can get to questions pretty quickly actually now. So I think for all of you guys in organizations, you might want to think about what does an automation journey look like for you, and where should it go? There's really, I think, three simple steps to think about. And there's a couple of things here that I think are really interesting, and that if you can start thinking about early on, can make big differences. And the first is in preparation, something called radical candor. And that's being really super honest and really humble about what data you actually have and what your potential outcomes could be with the data you have. And you know, that lack of humility for the quality of the data is also what caused some of these problems. You know, there's a big history of these things, especially at sort of a governmental level. I pick on the government because I think you know, these are things that we can all see really immediately have big impacts on people's lives. So there's automated decision making in policing, which has been challenged in the courts successfully in several countries. Most recently in the UK, there was a challenge to a visa streamlining process, which was being run by algorithms, which was absolutely proven to be racist. And you know, the government had to withdraw and retract the entire algorithm and put a new system in place. That's a really recent, I don't know if any of you've seen that in news. In a lot of ways, probably they dodged a bullet in sort of the PR of that one, because I think the stink around it was actually greater than the A-levels one, because it ran for longer and had a broader impact on more people's lives for a much longer period. So being really honest with yourselves about what the data is and where your bias might come from, and understanding your limitations early on, will save you a lot of problems later in life and later in the process. And the other one I think that really is interesting is in generating exhaust data. So when you look at your data interfaces, a lot of people think about how to automate collection, how to eliminate data entry, you know, elimination of human entered data is great. But what we still haven't gotten very good at looking at is the incidental metadata around activities that we can capture in this digital world. And those are the really interesting data points that can help to inform nuance in your algorithms. And those are the bits of data that are probably the most valuable right now. So you're all recruiters. I think it's probably worth tying some of this back to, like, why should you care? Why should we be thinking about this aside from the broader societal impacts? And actually, before we get to that, one thing here on, on the idea of your automation journeys and thinking about the ethics, if you're really interested in the sorts of organizations that are working on our behalf as a society to combat the problems with algorithms that are impacting our lives, you should look at an organization called Foxglove. I can send a link later. They're a sort of a legal-based charity, rights charity. You know, I would encourage supporting organizations like that, and at a you know, bare minimum, following the work that they publish, you will be better informed and better able to understand the impacts of these things, looking at the output of organizations like that. They're very active. They're relatively well-funded. And I think most interestingly, from my point of view, is they have a very clear mission around looking and combating algorithmic bias and algorithmic justice, and especially governmental misuse of technology, and looking after our data as sort of, you know, global citizens. And those are, I think, are really worthwhile aims. So From a recruitment perspective, you know, what are sort of some of the things that we can be anticipating or see already? I mentioned earlier that I'm involved sort of with two companies, right? So I sit with Eva on a very part-time basis now, but one of the big projects that I was speaking to you guys about last year that we were spinning up was a piece of work with the United Nations disaster teams. And that project is now going full steam ahead. And, you know, this slide here was actually a slide I shared last year as a sort of a desired state. The really exciting, interesting thing about this is that we've moved beyond a desired state with this, and this is now an actual live state. So in the output of this project, what we are able to do is to use conversational interfaces, chatbots and other voice interfaces, things like that, to collect information from a list of qualified disaster-related specialities all across the globe. These are people who work under contract. They get on a list for the UN, and when there's a problem somewhere in the world, the UN's deployment team, disaster deployment team, deploys the appropriate resource from that list to that country. But that team is only four people, and the rate at which they've been called on to provide new resource has been doubling and tripling every year. And they reached a point where they don't have the resources to add more people to the team and couldn't cope with the anticipated increase in demand. And so what the EVA project with the UN has been working on is automating their processes. So it's a very narrow project. It's very definable. It's not looking at, you know, thousands of applications from people who are, you know, maybe, you know, 100,000 graduates applications, where it's really hard to discern key things. You know, I don't think, you know, we're not talking about technology that's ready at that level for that sort of fine grain discernment. But we're working with a sort of a pre-approved group of people. So there is some human approval in the process, but once someone has made it through human approval stage, you still have a list of over 18,000 specialists that need to be deployed, and you need to understand both their availability, their location, and all the rest of it, their ability to be deployed to that particular region. There's a number of interesting factors that come together in allowing someone to go and work in a country in a disaster recovery capacity. And so the project that we've been working on delivering with the UN over the last 18 months now has been able to supplement the existing team to really dramatically change the way that that can be delivered. And some of the current results that we're looking at is that using robots only, so conversational chatbots, effectively, as you might understand them, only, we've got at the moment a 76% engagement rate across all of these workers. Bearing in mind, these are high knowledge workers. The average earnings for one of these, so the average contract that they would operate on is $100,000 for 6 months of work. So these are highly skilled, very knowledgeable, high value assets, and operating in complex environments, and they're happy and able and willing, by and large, to engage with the chatbot to be involved in the process. And what that's allowed us to do is to then use several algorithms and automation features to largely automate a lot of the manual work that was happening to allocate and to make these things work. And so now the team are able to do the things that really matter, which is coordinate in country with the people who are right, in the consular level, to be able to make sure that once the right team has been assembled, that they can actually get onto the ground as quickly as possible. it's a rip-roaring success, and it's a great example of how successful AI can be in a very tightly defined scale and a tightly defined project. If you guys have any questions about this sort of thing, I'd be happy to talk to you about it in more detail. Or I can put you in touch with the CEO of EVA. His name's Ben Kaminsky. I'll share contact details for everyone at the end of it if you've got any questions about this sort of stuff. If it's the sort of thing you're interested in for your own organization, certainly in terms of internal employee mobility, I think it's a proven model now that could really transform the way people manage workforces internally, especially large workforces. And so to kind of wrap it all up, I know I've kind of bounced around a lot of different ideas here, but I thought worth just kind of revisiting this sort of slide as well. Like, where do we think this is headed? So I think some of the markers have been laid down that the whole COVID and lockdown thing has certainly shifted the way people think about doing work and what the future of work will look like. I think some of the most interesting things that we see are just slight amends to themes that were already big trends. So where everything was about mobile first communications, now we're seeing that it's actually multi-threaded communications. These are my predictions. I guess I'm standing on the work of Forrester here, but I've amended these to where I think this will go in the next 5 years rather than where Forrester thinks the world would have been by now. And one of the things I'm seeing really very obviously is this huge trend to social channels and to video first as the way that people want to communicate. So that throws up all sorts of questions. And this is some of the stuff that in my current role at Volume that we're examining quite deeply. So one of the things we've been working on in using deep neural networks, deep learning, and a whole lot of reinforcement learning as well, is how do we train AI to be better at understanding people's intents? So, and the reason that's important is because if more of the communication is happening over spoken channels, and so in videos, in video calls, and all the rest of it, how do we take that data and turn that into useful machine readable information that we can then build processes off of? And and I think the move of the way that we communicate to more social channels, video, chat, and email presents a number of challenges. I put them in that order specifically as well. I think that's the order of priority and of importance that these channels will take. I think, pre-lockdown, we would have said that face-to-face was a pretty important channel and email was right up there with it. But certainly in the work that that the marketing side of our business at Volume does, we're seeing that social, video, and chat are driving much greater engagement and results out of the work that people are doing. So I think the other thing that's probably really interesting is the way that digital has totally shifted people's expectations of what digital can deliver versus and also has reshaped their expectations of a physical experience. A much more blended experience is sort of the accepted norm already, and that's only in a few months of changing, forcing change on people's behaviors, and that I think is only going to accelerate because it's great and people love it, and there's loads of data to back that up, and again some interesting things probably to talk about there in questions. Resource scarcity, we're talking about graduates here. You might say there's loads of graduates and they're struggling to find jobs. Is there actually a resource scarcity there? But there's always an imbalance in these systems, so resource scarcity just shifts around. But really understanding where you can apply the resources you have to greatest effect is one of the things that your data and AI can really help you with. And so understanding the analytics and the decision making behind that is a huge growth area and something I think we're only going to see get more traction. And the skills shortage globally hasn't actually changed. Although there are more people out of work, the type of work and the type of skills that this was referring to in 2016 are still skills that are in shortage today. And so I don't think that in a material way that this global skills shortage is being resolved by changes in unemployment. And actually, that's still one of the biggest challenges that we need to address, and that AI will start to address, because people will start to build on something that I call their technology quotient. So this is an idea based around how you use technology to sort of turn yourself into an Iron Man, if you like, sort of idea. You know, if you guys are familiar with the cartoon, the comic book character Iron Man, you know, he dons on a technology suit that gives him superhuman powers, but actually it's just a normal person. And I think that's going to be the augmented worker and the augmented human is the real big output of the next 5 years. So that's all from me. I know it's a lot of different topics, a lot of different things to kind of think about and mull over. But questions and any thoughts or ideas anyone wants to bounce off me, or any questions about any of the projects, anything like that, fire away.
Brilliant. Thank you. That was excellent, Max, and such a huge topic to cover in 30 minutes. So I appreciate you giving us and our members an overview, and particularly your project with the UN. Because we did have a few questions leading up to that point about any examples of real live projects that you've been working on. So to understand a little bit more about the scale of the project over the last 18 months with the UN and the early successes you've had was very illustrative of the benefits of AI. So that's great. I was wondering, from my point of view, having seen obviously technology comes right in the fore of a lot of recruiters' desktops at the moment, because we've had to rely on working remotely. And I'm wondering whether this has gone in the favour of developments in AI and ML, and you're having more inquiries from organisations saying, you know, we're trying technology a lot more, we're kind of more relaxed about this, maybe it's time now to take on these projects. So have you noticed an uptick in inquiries and you know, some of the project work that you're doing?
It's been interesting, actually. So you know, again, kind of looking at it from the perspective of two companies that are both technology businesses, but operating quite different verticals, right? So for the Eva business, one of the things that we've seen that's been really interesting is how our existing recruitment agency customers have thrived using the Eva platform technology. Right. So we've got both of them are in you know, I think the vertical helps. A lot of our customers at Eva were in healthcare of some sort or another. One of those is in social work though, primarily, and the allocation of social workers on a contract basis. They have seen their productivity scale exponentially, and we've got some case studies on the website you can have a look at to kind of understand how well they're faring with this. But you know, for them, it's been a journey, right? And we've had that journey with them. We've had highs and lows there. You know, I remember 3 months into that relationship, getting on a call with them, and the guys saying, you know, oh, we're not sure if we made the right decision. This is feeling really hard. You know, it's not all going our way, and having to help them navigate and negotiate that kind of feeling, that anxiety of, oh, you know, we thought we'd see immediate results, but you know, it feels like it's taking longer than we expected, and saying, hey, look, you know, that's okay, that's normal. Just trust the process. You know, keep committing to the thing, keep doing the work, and kind of following along with the process, and it will build, and it's additive, right? Because this is, you know, go back to the heart of what these systems are about, machine learning. It's about learning. It takes time to learn for a machine or for a human. And so from that point of view, those businesses and the rate at which we're able to expand in those organizations and to grow the scale of the projects has been phenomenal. This has not slowed any of that down at all. From a new customer acquisition point of view, though, it has slowed things down because people don't have the capacity to take on new systems. They are too worried about all the other existential problems of their business. So we expect to see that change over the next 12 to 18 months. We expect to see that change really significantly. Some of the work that we've been doing in the background there is really about gearing the business up ready for that next growth phase. I think, you know, we'll come out of this with great customer stories, really good, strong, as it's called, social proof, you know, in the terms of customers that have then been with us for over 2 years and have seen great results using the technology. So those strong use cases, I think, are something that going into this period, as a business, as a startup, the business is only 3 years old, just didn't have. We spent 18 months building the product, never mind taking it to market, right? And then on the flip side of that, I'm in a technology business that's that builds everything from right now in volume, where we do everything from augmented and virtual reality through to natural language understanding and conversational interfaces, all that sort of stuff. And we have a huge marketing practice as well. The business started out as a digital marketing agency 23 years ago, and that business has absolutely accelerated. We are hiring at probably about 5 new people every month, and have been since March. There's been no slowdown for us. In fact, in that sense, we've seen the same consolidation with our clients. People who are already investing ahead of the curve have doubled down on those investments, and that has benefited us. And people who are looking to the future are looking at ways to use these sorts of technology. So I think, it depends on the sector and on where your money is. In volume, the majority of our clients are other large technology businesses, and so they are they're more cash rich than recruitment businesses are, and certainly than recruitment budgets have been for larger companies. So I think, the overall, I would say that the period has been positive.
Okay, that's good. That's good. We've had a few questions that are essentially around the subject of putting a business case forward. So presumably an HR team would have to liaise with the IT team and actually collaborate to put this business case forward if they were to start to, get involved in an AI project. I mean, what are the top three things they could include in a business case or a proposal to the board?
So it's really difficult, right? Because one of the things that you'll find with these sorts of things is that everyone expects you to put an ROI on this. And the honest truth here, I cut through all of the sales crap and all the rest of it. You cannot right now, this technology is too young to put a confident ROI number on it. The impact for every organization will be so different just given that the way your organization collects, handles, and controls its data will be different to another organization, and the data that you have available to you will be different, never mind the complex kind of integration of all your different systems, accessibility to data, the challenges in going live, the total investment to implement the same system as we've done in the UN in another organization could be 5 times what the UN has spent. It's really unlikely to be less than what they've spent, by the way. We ran a really tight project in a part of that business is known as in part of the organization is known as Lighthouse Projects. And I think that's probably one of the ways to look at really delivering innovation and making a use case, making a good business case for this sort of stuff, is to say to your board, rather than, hey, look, we're trying to build this, you invest X, Y over these years and you're going to see this return, rather say, this is where our business is now. This is where we want it to be in 3 years' time. These are the sorts of, this is how we think the world will change, and this is how we would like to be able to respond to those changes ahead of the curve. And in that respect, we believe that investing in this sort of technology will pay dividends over the long term, but we can't quantify what those dividends will be in year one and year two. But what we can absolutely see in the examples we already have access to is that the dividends are there, and they pay back in different ways for different organizations. And that, I think, it's really tricky. The other part of this is if you're in an organization that has an innovation stream inside of its executive decision-making process, so you have someone who is primarily responsible for innovation already, you need to be talking to that person first. If you don't have that innovation stream, it's really hard to get a project like this off the ground successfully.
Yeah, that's good advice. And I mean, it's very, very hard with a lot of new projects to prove that there's going to be an ROI down the line. But invariably, this is what the board are looking for, some sort of definite return. You know, maybe if it's not financial, that, you know, there could be, you know, metrics that you could use that we're going to improve our diversity, we're going to improve retention. So perhaps there's other returns on investment that you could put forward if
we're like talking about return on effort, right? So right. That can work as a really good metric or a KPI. You know, that right now you are you can measure how much effort you have to input into a system to deliver your current KPIs, and we could we could make a really good guess at how much we could reduce that total effort in order to achieve the same result, or conversely, how much you'd be able to scale your results if you could, use a force multiplier to change the total delivery of your effort.
Right. Or the cost of not doing this project is another one you could use, I suppose.
Yeah. Those sorts of sums are so easy to argue with, and I find that actually become a distraction if you're building a business case, because invariably the CFO is going to have a question about it, someone in ops is going to have a different question about it, and you know, and challenging those assumptions becomes like part of the game rather than kind of, you know, getting on board with the idea that actually we've got an opportunity to really change the way we operate. I think they're sort of quite clever traps almost that that, you know, I've seen people fall into time and time again. I've fallen into myself, and so, you know, certainly for me, when I'm working with a new organization, I don't talk about ROI as anything that we even want to think about in, you know, before year three. We're just talking about how will this make the life of a user better, and what impact will it have on your operational abilities in year one, year two, year three.
Good. Okay. That's great. Thank you very much, Max. We're out of time, but this has been recorded, so I will be uploading this to the GRN YouTube channel, so members can play this session back. And also on the GRN LinkedIn forum, Max will kindly make himself available to answer any questions that you perhaps weren't able to answer during the webinar, and for our other members, because this is a very, very interesting subject right now, and it has crept up the list of a lot of recruiters' to-do list. And generally, boards seem to be a lot more on side with this, with a lot of other projects being fast-forwarded with the situation. I think maybe now there may be some more serious conversations around AI and machine learning with regard to recruitment. So the next webinar will be in October. I'll update our Eventbrite page very, very soon. So we'd love to have you along for that as well. Finally, thank you everyone for giving up your time today to join in the webinar, and also to Max for, you said, your third outing with us.
Questions. If anybody wants to ask me a question on LinkedIn, just tag me, you know, at Max Knupfer in the question. That makes sure I definitely see it in my notifications, because my LinkedIn is a bit mad at the moment. So that would be really useful. I'll make sure I get back to you that way.
Lovely. Appreciate your time, Max. And hopefully we'll get you along another time for another update with some new and fresh insights.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks everyone for your questions.
Marvelous. Thank you very much.
Take care.